Luke 22:35-71, the 86th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on December 7, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We have 2, possibly 3 weeks to finish up the Gospel of Luke, so that's what we're going to try to blitz through a chunk of it this morning. We kind of left off in a section where Jesus is in the upper room. They're having his last Passover meal, and after the meal, he's talking to them. Right in the middle of the meal, he has indicated that Judas is the one who's going to betray him. It's difficult to prove this, but I didn't comment on this as we were going through there. It's difficult to prove this, but it sure looks like there's a really ironic thing going on in the interaction between Judas and Jesus in the upper room. Jesus knows exactly what Judas is going to do. He knows that it's been predestined before the foundation of the world that he's going to do that on the one hand. On the other hand, Jesus seems to be reaching out to Judas to try to induce him to repentance. That this whole section is full of incredible ironies revolving around the distinction between human responsibility, repentance, freedom on the one hand, and God's sovereignty and God's sovereign purposes on the other hand. If there's no better place to go to realize that even though Jesus and the biblical authors are divine determinists, they are not fatalists. So we'll see that over and over here again in this section, that Jesus is making rational choices about what ought to be in the circumstances in which he's in, even when he knows that God's sovereign purposes are not going to be thwarted anyway. So even though he is confident that God's sovereign purposes are not going to be thwarted, he doesn't wax fatalistic ever. Quite to the contrary, he's always appealing to people to act in their freedom and to act responsibly. This interaction with Judas, I think, is just the beginning of that and one of those, because why would you appeal to someone to repent when you know that he's been the son of perdition from before creation? Well, because you know he has freedom. And you know he could do other than that. You know he could make a more responsible choice. You know he could be loyal. You know he could be loving. If he doesn't, it's because he chooses not to. And it's that Jesus is appealing to. Make the right choice, Judas. Then we finished last week with the same kind of interaction with Peter. And notice you have the same dialectic going on there. Peter is going to deny him. He's predicted it as a prophet. And yet, the way he interacts with him, I would argue, is very tender in trying to woo him into a different perspective. But we broke that off in order to go later in the chapter to compare Jesus' prediction of Peter's denials with the actual denials themselves. So there's a section that Luke includes that we skipped over, and I'm going to go back to that now. We're in 22:35. And he said to them, "When I sent you out without money, belt, and bag and sandals, did you not lack? You did not lack anything, did you?" They said, "No, nothing." And he said to them, "But now, whoever has a money belt is to take it along, likewise also a bag. And whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and buy one. For I tell you that this which is written will be fulfilled in me." And he was numbered with transgressors, for that which refers to me has its fulfillment. They said, "Lord, look, here are 2 swords. And he said to them, "It is enough." Okay, this is a rather bizarre passage on the surface, but I think to understand it, we need to understand the circumstances he's in, the occasion, and what's driving him here. First of all, he reminds them of two instances in their life when he sent them out as missionaries to declare the coming of the kingdom of God, first in Galilee and the other time was in the Transjordan region. And he sent them from village to village, town to town, to proclaim the good news of the coming of the kingdom. And as we looked at that, what did he mean by the coming of the kingdom? He meant the arrival of the king, himself the king. When he did that, Jesus had the disciples enter into a little sort of experiment. Don't take any provision to take care of yourself. Rely only and entirely on God to take care of you. And what happened? They were taken care of. Jesus is reminding them of that here. When I sent you out without money belt and bag and sandals, you did not lack anything, did you? Wasn't God quite fully capable of taking care of you and providing for you, keeping you safe and keeping you fed and giving you shelter? And they acknowledge that they didn't lack for anything. Now he says to them, but now, and what he means by now, that the crucial question is, what does he mean by now? Is this some kind of turning point in cosmic history? Before, that's the way you were supposed to operate, but now you're supposed to operate differently. I don't think so. I think he means tonight, on this occasion tonight, now tonight, whoever has a money belt is to take it along, likewise also a bag, and whoever has no sword is to sell his coat and buy one. And then Jesus tells them what his rationale is. For I tell you that this which is written will be fulfilled in me. And he was numbered with transgressors. For that which refers to me has its fulfillment. I don't remember. I've got it here. It's Isaiah 53 that he's alluding to or even quoting when he says he was numbered with transgressors. What Isaiah 53 is predicting is the fact that this Messiah, when he comes, is going to be executed like a criminal. He will be treated as if he is a rebel and an ungodly evildoer. That's how he's going to be treated. Well, because he's going to be treated like an evildoer, Jesus says, I think we better have some swords. On the one hand, it's kind of comical and kind of silly, but I have to think that Jesus doesn't know Pilate. And Jesus understands that the Sanhedrin wants him dead, but the Sanhedrin wants him dead for reasons that aren't going to be particularly compelling to a Roman governor. A Roman governor could care less about any kind of bad theology or deceptive claims by a Jewish rabbi. I mean, he doesn't care about that. The only thing the Roman governor cares about is any threat to Roman authority and Roman power. Jesus presumably doesn't know the character, the person of Pilate, and he knows that the Sanhedrin, in order to get him, Jesus, dead, is going to have to sell the case to Pilate that Jesus and his men are dangerous. So Jesus is looking ahead and going, okay, we're going to get arrested pretty soon. I'm going to get arrested pretty soon, and I'm going to have to go before Pilate. Neither me nor my men have any money. Neither me nor my men have any weapons. We don't exactly look dangerous, you guys. Can we look dangerous? Can we do something to make it a sellable case to Pilate that that we're criminals? So he's asking them, we no longer should be looking like a ragtag group of men who are trusting in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We need to look like revolutionaries. We need to look like bandits or criminals or something. So does anybody have any swords? We've got two. That'll be enough. Well, that's not enough to go against the guard that came against them. It was a whole crowd of people that came against them. Two swords wasn't going to cut it. It doesn't have any practical value. That's not why he wants them to have swords. As we're going to see, the only one who used the sword, Jesus says, what are you doing? don't be fighting here. So this is not a matter of military strategy here. This is a matter of symbolism and really of political expedience here. we need to play into the dynamics of the story that's unfolding, and let's dress the part, because we know what part we're going to play right here tonight, so let's dress the part. What's interesting is when he meets Pilate face to face and they actually talk, Jesus doesn't seem to have the same concerns any longer. I think that's interesting, because finally when he comes face to face with Pilate, as we'll see, and Pilate says, "Are you a king?" Jesus doesn't remain silent or do anything to kind of enhance the threat that Pilate feels. In fact, quite the contrary, Jesus plays it straight. And he says, "Well, yeah, but my kingdom is not of this world." And as we will see in the account, Pilate isn't exactly threatened by Jesus. So how do we reconcile, if I'm right in my reading of this account, how do we reconcile what Jesus is doing in this account with his later interview with Pilate? I think the answer has to be, by the time the interview comes around, he understands Pilate. And he understands that there's no way this man is not going to give him up. So he doesn't have to worry about selling the case. The Jews, the Sanhedrin, is doing a great job of selling the case in just the right kind of way to make Pilate bite. So Jesus can speak straightly and forthrightly with Pilate, and he doesn't think that he's causing any problems. Okay, this happens as they are traveling from the city of Jerusalem, from the upper room. They're traveling out of the city, down into the valley of the Kidron, back up into the Mount of Olives, toward the Garden of Gethsemane, which had been apparently the customary hiding place of Jesus during this last week, when he would hide out at night. So now we see him arrive at the Mount of Olives, 22:39. And he came out and proceeded, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him too. When he arrived at the place, he said to them, "Pray that you don't succumb to temptation." Then he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and falling to his knees, he began to pray, saying, "Father, if you are willing, make this cup go away from me, and yet it should not be my will, but yours." Now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him, and being in agony, he kept praying with an intense seriousness. Indeed, his sweat came to be as drops of blood falling down upon the ground. When he got up from his prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping from their sorrow. And he said to them, "Why are you sleeping? Get up and keep praying that you don't succumb to temptation." We'll stop there. So as was his custom, what he means by his custom is his customary hiding place during this last week, when he had to escape the capture by the temple guard. He goes to the Mount of Olives. We know from elsewhere it's the Garden of Gethsemane, and the disciples followed him. They get to the place, and he says, "Pray that you don't succumb to temptation." I remember this is very vividly reading this passage over and over again as a child, and just not getting it. I mean, I didn't understand what was going on here. And what I was missing is the background. This is our tendency as Christians. We're encouraged to take everything that the Bible says and assume that it has immediate, direct, universal application to all of us as believers. He's talking to a particular group of people at a particular time in history who are facing or on the threshold of an incredible trial. And Jesus knows that. So when he says, "Pray that you don't succumb to temptation," this is not an exhortation to a particular religious practice that all Christians are to engage in throughout their lives and throughout history. This is what they're to do now. "If I were you," Jesus says, "I'd be on my knees praying that you don't succumb to temptation." Now, why is he saying that? Because he knows how severe the test that they're about to confront is. We've talked about this before, but let me just remind you that this word that's translated temptation, there's two Greek words that get used to describe the things that come at us in life that sort us out and test us and see what we're committed to. One is usually translated test. The other is either translated trial or temptation, depending upon the context. The one word that's translated test is like our word maybe evaluate. To be tested is to be evaluated. The question is, what's being evaluated? And I would argue what's being evaluated is not primarily the moral nature of my being, because it should become clear soon enough in life that the basic fundamental nature of my being is broken, is evil, is corrupt. We are all corrupt. But there's two kinds of corrupt people. There are people who, in their corruption, are ultimately committed to their corruption from the existential personal commitments of their heart. And there's people who hate their own corruption, who repudiate their own corruption, who reject it, and are doing what they can in life to strive against the evil that is them. That's the difference between the child of God and the child of the devil. Well, what gets tested are those commitments, not our character. We're always going to fail if what is being evaluated is our character. We always show forth one way or another our self-centeredness, our depravity, our evil, twisted thoughts and values and so on. That's always going to come out one way or the other. But what the test that we can pass is, if we are children of God, it can become clear that my heart is committed to a vision of an entirely different way of being. I'm committed to righteousness, even though I am fundamentally unrighteous. Well, the question here is a subset. What's being tested here is a subset of that. One manifestation of that kind of right orientation toward goodness and God and the things of God is our commitment to Jesus himself. What are you going to do with him? Those who reject Jesus are rejecting God and everything he stands for. Those who ultimately embrace Jesus do so because they are accepting God and his role and everything that he values. In this case, with these disciples, what's going to be tested is, as we saw in the case of Peter in particular, what is your relationship to me going to be, Peter? Is your commitment to me the most important defining feature of your life or not? Well, every one of these disciples is going to face, in their own way, in their own personal journey, what they're going to do with the fact that this man that they have believed to be the king, believed to be the Messiah, coming to enter into the kingdom that's been promised him by God himself, has ended up dead on a cross by the Romans. They're going to have to decide what they're going to do with that and what they're going to do about that. And as you look at the accounts at the end of the Gospels and Acts, they were afraid, they were terrified, they were confused, they were discombobulated. They didn't know what to do with this. Could they have come out by saying, forget this? This is absurd. This is ridiculous. This is not what I signed up for. I'm not interested in following this Jesus who managed to get himself killed on the cross. That was absolutely possible. There's no way that wouldn't have been a very likely and plausible storyline for their lives. Apart from Judas, though, not a one of them ended up being lost. Every one of them hung in there and stayed committed to it. But Jesus knows, now here's another part of that tension between freedom and God's sovereignty. Jesus has told them earlier in his ministry, not a one of you will be lost except one of you, right? So Jesus knows they're going to make it. So why bother praying? Why bother praying if there's already the guarantee from the Father that they're going to make it? Well, because what is true at the level of God's purposes is true and firm and secure, and nothing can thwart it and nothing can undermine it. But we don't live there. We live down here where we are free and where we must make choices and where we must decide, where we must be courageous when it's time to be courageous, and we must be right when it's time to be right, and we must tell the truth when it's time to tell the truth. And we have to, in our freedom, make all those choices. So Jesus, knowing the test that awaits them and the responsibility that they have, is needing to, is suggesting to them, now is the time to be praying, that God who promised you will uphold you and keep you in the faith and not allow you to throw it over when the time comes, because you're going to be sorely tested. Now, the word translated here, I translated it, most English translations translate it tempted. It's a different word than the word for testing, for evaluation. It's a word that sometimes means trial, but it can also mean temptation. And I think the way to understand that is, think of two armies going up against each other back in the days when you didn't have the technology and the weapons, where people didn't have to fight at all, but back in the days where people fought each other. And one general would send his soldiers to test the enemy line. He was trying it. Now, why was he trying it? He was trying it because he was looking for a point of weakness or vulnerability in the enemy line. And why would he be interested in finding that? Because his goal was to destroy the enemy. He was going to exploit that weakness, was going to attack that weakness, and destroy the enemy by so doing. That is the perspective from the New Testament standpoint of Satan. Satan tries our commitments because his goal and his agenda is to destroy our faith and to destroy our relationship with God. What does that look like? We have an English word for the experience of having the weaknesses of our commitment assailed and assaulted in that way, such that we feel vulnerable and we could abandon our commitment to what's right and good and true, and we call that temptation. So I think temptation is a very apt term to describe what we're talking about here. From the perspective of God, God tries in order to expose our weakness, in order that we can resolve differently, that we can repent of my weakness, repent of my lack of commitment, repent of my lack of clear focus and clear devotion to what's true, and therefore become a believer. That's God's agenda in trying us. Satan's agenda is to destroy us. So this same thing that the disciples are going through, from God's perspective, it's ultimately to strengthen their faith. From Satan's perspective, it is to destroy their faith. But either way, it's a hard time. It's rough. Pray that you don't succumb to temptation. Pray that you don't fail, in other words, in this test, and give up your commitment to me, to Jesus. Well, the same temptation to the disciples, that one of the reasons Jesus knows it's a temptation for them is because it's a temptation for him. And that's what we see in what's following. Then he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and falling to his knees, he began to pray, saying, Father, if you are willing, make this cup go away from me. And yet it should not be my will, but yours. By this cup going away from him, he's just envisioning a cup with some draft of some kind in it. And this draft is some sort of noxious beverage that he's really not interested in drinking. He would rather not have to drink it. So he's saying, if you are willing, Father, make this cup go away from me. Make me not have to drink what's in this cup before me. And yet, it should not be my will, but yours. This is maybe perhaps the most poignant statement in the whole of the Bible. I mean, it is so quintessential to what it means to be a believer, to what it means to be a child of God. That Jesus is just so gracefully here, as portrayed as so gracefully here, on the one hand acknowledging sincerely and earnestly and energetically that he doesn't really like what's about to happen. It's not his desire to go and be flogged and whipped and mocked and ultimately crucified and die a painful death. That's not what he would choose for himself. And yet, with some kind of spiritual jujitsu, I can't even say it, judo, is able to turn that into, but it's not really about me, is it, Father? It's not really a matter of what I want, is it? It's really kind of about what you want. And that's as it should be, and that's what I want. But that should be the paradigm for all of us in all of our lives, because that's just life. That's the reality that we live in, is that sooner or later, one way or another, life is going to throw at us something that we're really, frankly, not interested in going through. I don't want to endure it. I don't want to experience. I don't want to face it. I just want to be spared having to go through this at all. And yet, and at that point, we are being tested, because the question that we face into then is, what's more important, Jack, that you get what you want or that God gets done what he wants done? Do you want God to accomplish what the God of the universe has set out to accomplish, or do you want it to be good for you, Jack? Well, I don't think I have to tell you what comes so naturally to us. The answer that rises to our lips immediately is, what's good for me? Could we do that? Of course that's what we want. I mean, that's part and parcel of our bad, broken, corrupted orientation as creatures, is we forget we're creatures. We have forgotten that I wouldn't even have any existence if I weren't here in order to play out the purposes of God and to accomplish the will of God. I wouldn't even have existence. So the very purpose of my existence is to play whatever role and undergo whatever it is that God wants me to undergo in order that his narrative gets told, the one that he has willed to exist, the one that he wants to be. Well, Jesus, rather gracefully in this one statement, makes that transition. You see his humanity. I don't much like being crucified on the one hand, but then you see his righteousness, but it's not about me. I don't want it to go my way. I want it to go your ways. Then the text goes on. Now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And being in agony, he kept praying with an intense seriousness. Indeed, his sweat came to be as drops of blood falling down upon the ground. When he got up from his prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping from their sorrow. And he said to them, why are you sleeping? Get up and keep praying that you don't succumb to temptation. Okay, we're told here, and this is the only gospel that has this comment, that an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. I'm still working on this. I don't know if this angel is actually an angel. I don't see any reason that it shouldn't be or couldn't be. It may very well be that. But I'm inclined to think that the Greek word angelos in certain contexts is not so much an angel the way we think of an angel and the way we'll see an angel here next week at the tomb of Jesus. Not in the form of a being, but it may be any kind of divine revelation, any kind of divine vision that is given to someone can be called an angelos. We don't have enough information here to know which. If I'm right about that, then we don't have enough information here to know which of those is in view. Either way, I think it's quite clear what's happening when it appeared to him, strengthening him. What would be the nature of that strengthening? I think it would be wrong to think of this being an angelic being who just touches him on the shoulder and you see sparks fly and there's a magical strengthening of Jesus. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's more like what happened on the Mount of Transfiguration when Jesus went up on the high mountain and he took James and John and Peter with him, and Moses and Elijah appear. And Moses and Elijah, the text says, spoke to him about his coming departure, or something to that effect. It has all the appearances of Moses and Elijah encouraging Jesus to follow through with his mission, and namely his mission to go and die for the sins of the world, to voluntarily, freely give himself up to be crucified for your and my sins. That was not, could not have been an easy decision for Jesus to make. I mean, you make a huge mistake if you think this is God, therefore it was a piece of cake. I mean, God can do anything. He can even be crucified. Well, sure. But we're not looking at God as God. We're looking at God as a man, as a human being. And this is a human being who made the decision. It would be like you making the decision to be willing to undergo what he underwent in order that the sins of the world might be displayed as subject to the wrath of God in the way that Jesus did. I'm too selfish. I wouldn't have done that. Let them all go to hell. Just save me. Or something along those lines. I mean, isn't that the impulse in every one of us? You find another stinking way, God. I'm not going to be part of that. I'm not going to do that for you. So this had to be an incredibly difficult decision for him to make. And God was working with him throughout his life, little by little, bit by bit, to encourage him and persuade him that this is well worth doing. I think that's happening one last time here in the Garden of Gethsemane. Some kind of information is coming Jesus' way, a vision of his future glory, perhaps, an angel speaking to him of his future glory. Why, in Philippians, Paul tells us that he endured the cross for the glory set before him. Why was he willing to do that? Because ultimately it made him the most important and the most special, the preeminent person in the entire universe, the preeminent being. And so in order to attain to the glory that God had promised him, he was willing to suffer and endure the cross. Well, somehow now is a good time for him to get reinforced in him this vision of this future glory that is in store for him. So there was some kind of information, and maybe there were several dimensions to it, but some kind of information that was reminding him of why he had made the decision to go to the cross in the first place. And that has the effect of strengthening him, of fortifying his resolve, fortifying his commitment. It says, and being in agony, he kept praying with an intense seriousness. Indeed, his sweat came to be as drops of blood falling down upon the ground. Stan Filarski gave me an article several years ago now by some medical doctors who talk about a physiological condition that is stress-induced. And I don't remember the mechanics of it or the details of it. But basically, what happens is you do begin to sort of bleed out of your pores. So your perspiration is turned red with blood having become mixed in with it, and you literally bleed out of your pores. But it happens only in times of extreme stress. Either that's what we're talking about here, or his sweat came to be as drops of blood in the sense that his sweat was pouring, that it was as if he was bleeding perspiration. I think it's impossible to tell from the Greek text because you could go either way. But if there is that condition, I think it's most likely that that's the condition that's being described here. Well, what that means is he's under extreme stress. And that should be very instructive to us. This is Jesus. This is the Son of God. This is the only sinless human being who's ever walked the planet so far. This is a man whose faith was impeccable, was unfailing, was perfect, was tested and never found wanting. So what is he doing not being tranquil? I mean, you see, the problem is that we've been told so often within Christian culture that if you have the right kind of faith, then you will be able to live a peaceful and tranquil life. There will be no more stress. There will be no more agony. Certainly not the extreme kind of stress that causes a medical condition that none of us have ever heard of. You know, so how do we reconcile that? I think what we have to recognize is that we have been lied to by those voices in our culture that tell us that anxiety and fear and stress is contrary to faith. They're not contrary to faith. Jesus is stressed out because he does have faith. He believes beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's going to endure agonizing suffering, and he's got to do it, and he can't get out of it. He knows, and he believes that. He just doesn't want to do it. He doesn't want to experience it. And the conflict between what he knows is true and what he wants create this incredible stress and anxiety and tension in him. I mean, every one of us would have been afraid out of our ever-loving minds if we had any inkling at all of what he was about to go through. I mean, I would have been scared. And Jesus is frightened, he's afraid, and he's in anticipation of this thing going down. It is just heightened. All the physiological phenomena of stress are in overdrive here. Not because he doesn't believe, but because he does believe. So we mustn't let other people around us tell us when we are afraid of something that it's a lack of faith. It might be a lack of faith, but that's an entirely different question. The question of whether you lack faith or not is a different issue from whether you're afraid. There are many things to be afraid of in this world. There are many things to be anxious about and stressed by in this world. But if we define our existence by the reality of God in our lives, overseeing our lives, having his will be done, then we can go ahead and gulp and say, okay, I don't think I like what's ahead of me, but God, so be it. It's not about my will, but it's yours. It shouldn't be my will, it should be yours. So let's go for this ride, wherever it might take me. However bad it may be, however awful may be some aspects of the experience that you have in store for me, nonetheless, it's not about my will, it's about your will. So let's do it. That's faith. And I can say that with nothing but stark terror in my heart as I say that. That my emotional reaction is an entirely independent and different thing from my spiritual faith, my reaction spiritually. Now, not that there's not an interplay. Some people don't believe, and because they don't believe, they fear things they shouldn't fear. They fear things they have no right to fear. So my unbelief can aggravate my stress and my anxiety, make it worse than it has to be, because I really don't believe that God is there, or that God cares, or that he's capable, or whatever. But even if all of your ducks are in a row with respect to your faith, still, sometimes the will of God isn't very fun. And because it isn't very fun, I'm going to be afraid of it, and I'm going to be stressed by it. And that's what we find here with Jesus. When he got up from his prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping from their sorrow, and he said to them, "Why are you sleeping? Get up and keep praying that you don't succumb to temptation." He says they're sleeping from sorrow. Maybe that's not the best translation. I think the point that he's making is the past few days and hours have left them completely and totally at sea. They're just completely, completely confused by everything that's happening. And when you're confused and you're trying to sort something out and you can't sort it out, there comes a point where the escape of sleep is very, very welcome. I just need to shut down. The chaos of emotions that they've been experiencing, the intellectual chaos of not being able to figure it out and come to terms with it, to not really understanding what's going on, the combination of the intellectual and emotional chaos that they've been experiencing, they need to shut down. So they're sleeping. I think Jesus understands that. I think Jesus is sympathetic with that. I don't think this is in any kind of statement about Jesus being unsympathetic with them sleeping. But what he's saying is, but you guys don't understand. As much as you might want to shut down and escape, something really, really serious in your life is about to take place, I think you really ought to be praying. You ought to really be asking your Creator to not let you succumb to temptation. That is so vital. They're sleeping because they don't really get it. They're sleeping because they don't really understand how serious a test they're about to undergo. But Jesus does. So he's just warning them that they really, if they understood the time, they would understand that they need to be praying here. Now, while he was still speaking, this is 47. Now, while he was still speaking, behold, there was a crowd. Now, the one named Judas, one of the 12, was going before them, and he drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Jesus, are you delivering the Son of Man over with a kiss? As we've stated before, the heart and essence of Judas' betrayal was his leading this crowd through the valley up into the orchards on the Mount of Olives to Jesus' otherwise unknown hiding place. They could have captured him when he was in the marketplace during the day, but they would have risked causing a riot, and they didn't want to cause a riot. So they need to catch him apart from the public when there's no one else around. Well, they can do that at night if only they knew where he was hiding. For 30 pieces of silver, Judas was willing to lead them, guide them to Jesus' hiding place on the Mount of Olives. I think the temple guard doesn't quite know what to expect what kind of resistance they might meet. So they agree with Judas that we need the element of surprise. We need to be able to arrest Jesus right away, directly, immediately. So Judas, would you locate Jesus in the crowd of his disciples and go kiss him? We will know that that's him, and we will arrest him immediately. So he comes up, draws near to Jesus to kiss him, and Jesus notes the irony of this whole thing. Judas, are you delivering the Son of Man over with a kiss? One more time, I think. The problem with the biblical accounts is there's no tone of voice here. Is this sarcastic? Is this gentle? What is it? I read tender here, tender and gentle here. Judas, think about it. Really? Are you delivering the Son of Man over with a kiss? Maybe you need to stop in your life and think about what you're doing here. Again, I think he's reaching out to Judas. Jesus can still go to the cross, and it's not too late for Judas. Judas can still repent. So he's giving him something to think about. Judas, look at yourself. Look at the betrayal. Look at the inconsistency. Look at the lie. Look at the fraud here. You're delivering me over with a kiss? Now those who were around him, seeing what was about to occur, said, Lord, shall we strike with the sword? Then a certain one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. We know from the Gospel of John that it was, of course, Peter who did that. I have to wonder if part of why Peter didn't act was he had to have been stung by a few hours earlier, Jesus predicting his denial. Before the night's over, you're going to deny me three times. Peter's out to prove Jesus wrong. No, I'm a courageous defender of you, Jesus. So, bad shot, but a courageous defender. So he cut off the right ear of the slave of the high priest. But Jesus responding said, you must allow even this. And what he means by that is, you must allow me to be arrested. You must allow me to go to my death. Don't fight. Don't resist here. So the purpose of the swords was not resistance. Jesus never had in mind resistance. He was freely giving himself up to this death. And it's a very unfortunate act of Peter's impetuousness that this man lost his ear. A lesser man than Jesus would have left the man without an ear. It's just this incredible, one more time, act of compassion on Jesus' part. Look, I just didn't warn Peter in time. I'm sorry. let me fix your ear. But I think there's nothing but compassion driving him. I mean, there'd be really no other reason for him to heal it, except his compassion, I think. So touching his ear, he healed him. 52. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and officers of the temple and elders who had shown up to come after him, "Have you come out with swords and clubs, as if you were after a bandit? While I was in the midst of you day after day in the temple, you did not put forth your hands against me. Rather, this is the time for you, the hour and opportunity of darkness." And again, I don't think there's anything that there are, you could read some stuff into here that would be really cosmic and grand and impressive, but I don't think he's saying anything very profound here other than he's just noting their cowardice. You had plenty of opportunity when I was right there in front of you, and you had to hide. You had to sneak around in the dark and come and find me in my hiding place to capture me. And again, for any of them that have ears to hear, it would cause them to reflect on, well, where's this cowardice coming from? What am I made of? Am I about truth? Am I about righteousness? Am I about integrity? Or what am I about? Most of them probably don't have ears to hear, but to the extent that they do, he'd be prepared to get them thinking about that. Okay, then we have the account of Peter, and we looked at that last week, his denials, so I won't look at that again. So we pick up again in chapter 22:63. He's been arrested. Yeah, he's been arrested. Now the men who were keeping Jesus in custody kept making fun of him as they flayed him, and after they had blindfolded him, they kept asking him, saying, "Prophesy, who is the one who hit you?" Indeed, they persisted in saying many other outrageous things toward him, maligning him. So I think what we have here is the temple guard captures him, and they bring him first to Annas, who was basically the godfather of the chief priests. He was he had been the high priest in prior years, that the high priesthood had gone to his son-in-law, Caiaphas. I think that's his son-in-law. But even though Caiaphas is the nominal high priest, Annas is still sort of the patriarchal figure back behind the power of the high priesthood. So they take him first to Annas. Luke doesn't tell us this, but we know this from other gospel accounts. And then later they lead him to Caiaphas. Well, all this time they're having to go summon the council, the Sanhedrin, or at least part of the Sanhedrin, to get as much of the Sanhedrin as they can together to try Jesus. So that's going to take some time. In the meantime, Jesus is in the custody of these guards that have captured him. And that's what Luke is describing here. They kept making fun of him. They whipped him. They flayed him. They blindfolded him. And then they would take turns hitting him and ask him to prophesy, "Who is it that hit you?" And basically trying to make a mockery of him. Remember, this is Lord of Lords and King of Kings, the most important person in all of creation, being maligned and held in contempt by these puny little specks of dust by comparison. And again, it's to Jesus' credit that he signed up for this. He willingly went to this time of suffering and willingly accepted it, as in obedience to his Father. Now, as it became day, all this is happening in the middle of the night, and we are moving toward dawn. Remember Peter's, that was the rooster was crowing as he denied for the third time Jesus. So we're early in the morning, before sunup and coming on sunup. Now, as it became day, the council of elders over the people, that's the Sanhedrin, assembled, along with the chief priests and scribes. So they led him away into their council chamber. When they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us," he said to them, "If I were to tell you, you most certainly would not believe. And if I were to question you, you most certainly would not answer." And then some text, literally, there's a discrepancy in the manuscripts. Some manuscripts have, "You most certainly would not answer me, nor would you let me go." I'm inclined toward that toward that text. You most certainly would not answer me, nor would you let me go. But from now on, the Son of Man will be sitting at the right hand of the authority of God. This is an abbreviated digestion of what happens in the council. We get a fuller account of it in the other gospel accounts. Luke is giving us just the bare outline of what happened. They ask him to tell them if he is the Christ. And as Luke puts it here, what was Jesus' stance? Well, I could tell you, but what would be the point of that? You wouldn't believe me. And then, secondly, I could ask you to release me, but you wouldn't. You're not going to let me go. So you just decide what you want to do with me and have at it. But he does leave them with this, and this is true in all the gospel accounts. But from now on, the Son of Man will be sitting at the right hand of the authority of God. And the point that he's making is, I am shortly going to enter into my role, my authority, my function as at the right hand of God, as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So that's going to happen one way or the other. But I'm not going to tell you who I am. I'm not going to tell you that that's who I am directly, because you wouldn't believe me. And I'm not going to ask to be released. You're not going to release me. They all said, "You are the Son of God then." And he kept saying to them that based on his comment about sitting at the right hand of the authority on high. And they all said, you are the Son of God then. And he kept saying to them, "You said it, I am." So they said, "Why do we have need for any testimony? For we ourselves have heard it from his own mouth." In the other gospel accounts, they're trying to get other people to bear testimony to the fact that he has said something incriminating. And they are rather unsuccessful at that because the witnesses keep contradicting each other, and so they can't get a clear picture. So it's at that point when they have failed to get people to make fraudulent testimony against him. Jesus says, basically admits that he's the Christ. That's when they said, "Why do we have need of any other testimony? For we ourselves have heard it from his own mouth." And that's when they decide to take him to Pilate, because they think they now have what they need. I think I better stop there, because this is a good stopping place, and you might have some questions or comments.
Thanks, Jack. Yeah, this is really good. And one place I'm confused about, though, where the verse where it starts with verse 35, and where you said that he's knowing it, that he's going to be numbered with transgressors, and just thinking we better look the part, basically, is what you were saying. I'm thinking, I really like the way you were saying about them being defined determinists, but living in the moment. And I read this part the same way as Jesus is saying, when I sent you out before, you could see how God is just always taking care of you. But this is, I mean, in the whole context here, this is this intense moment. And you should, he's thinking of them, that they should be protected, and that for self-defense, have a sword. If someone came at one of them to kill them, that they would have a means of protection. I mean, that would be, in my mind, where his mind was going, that my love for you is right here in this moment, even though I know God's going to take care of you.
I read it exactly the opposite way. That I didn't explain this, but when he reminds them of how God has provided for them before, I think what he's wanting to do is set them up so that when they find themselves trapped in the garden by a bunch of armed men who are going to arrest Jesus, is it because God has failed? Has God failed to provide? Has God failed to keep them safe? No. What looks like failure to provide on God's part is God simply accomplishing his purposes and his will. because God is fully capable and fully willing to provide if it's in keeping with his will. And he's taking them back to those two experiments that they had in their life. We did this risky thing of sending you out traveling without provisions, and God took care of you, didn't he? Because my father, my father set us up for you doing this experiment, that you might know that he is there, that he is willing, and that he is able to provide for you and keep you safe. Well, you're about to experience something where God is not keeping me safe. So how are you going to think about this? Do you remember the lessons that you've learned earlier in your life? Remember those. Because my being arrested is not God's failure. It's God's will being done. It's not God's failure. So that's how I understood the relationship between them. There are a lot of people who will read the thing about the disciples being sent out and saying that should be the picture and the model and the paradigm for all of us today. If we really had faith, we would sell everything that we had and give it away and go out and just trust God. Well, those were incredibly unusual circumstances that Jesus put those disciples in. That's not normal human existence. Not what God expected normal human existence to be, not what God wants normal human existence to be. He wants us basically to responsibly take care of ourselves in the way that is rational to do. But he wants us to trust God as we're doing that. In these rare circumstances, these very special occasions, God had Jesus instruct his disciples, let's do something kind of spectacular and dramatic here. In order to teach my disciples that I am there, that I'm willing, I am able to provide and keep them safe. I want them to learn that dramatically. But that's not because that's a paradigm of faith itself. That's simply, if God hasn't promised you that kind of provision in the face of your lacking any proactive attempts to take care of yourself, you're not being faithful, you're being stupid. It's because God has promised that they could count on it.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. But that's just, I guess I'm just seeing Jesus more in the immediate moment here with the swords and the taking things like.
And let me see if I'm following you. You're seeing it as an act of love on his part toward the disciples that he doesn't want them to be unequipped to meet the challenge.
I wouldn't see him expecting them to protect him, but that they have some things
to protect
themselves.
Yeah.
But
okay, could be. The fact that he says two's enough, though, makes me think that's not really primarily what he's interested in. I mean, he'd want them all armed, I think, if this was a provision for their...
If you were really fearing that or something, but I think maybe just that extra, He knows they're not swordsmen or anything, but at least they've got something in case, I just think, someone was coming and they have some self-defense.
Well, it could be.
But
could be.
Anyway, but thanks.
Oh, were there any updates with the slave with the ear? Because he had a little miracle performed on him.
Yeah, well, remember last week in the when Peter was around the fire in the courtyard, one of the last people to accuse him of being a disciple was a relative of the man who had his ear cut off, who probably was with them in the garden as well and recognizes Peter as the swordsman who chopped his relative's ear off. Let's see. Any other update? I have this vague recollection that there is I'm reading an article where there's evidence that he may have become a believer, but I can't recall it right now, so, sorry.
Would the slave of the high priest been a person who carried a sword?
Yes, I would imagine so.
Well, there's some irony there then, because he came in with a sword and Jesus actually healed him too.
Right.
Sorry, Logan. So Jesus had super anxiety when he was waiting for the cross. Will you put that together with be anxious for nothing?
I'm sorry, with what?
Put that together with be anxious for nothing. that in all things by prayer and supplication let your requests be known to God, and the peace of God will, I guess, reign in your hearts or something like that.
Okay, let's see. I'd have to go back and look at it. I'm just talking off the top of my head without having, because I've never taught Philippians. But isn't the context there, he's learned how to be content in much and in little and so on. So I think when he says, be anxious for nothing, I don't think he's talking about what we think of as anxiety and stress. I think what he's saying is, don't make your life and your preoccupation about anything that you think you need to have and want to have. Don't be acquisitive. Don't be materialistic. Don't be greedy. Don't be grasping. Don't be making your life about the stuff that you think you have to get. That's not the context? Oh. Right. Okay. I'd have to look at it. I'm just not fresh. But it doesn't mean don't have stress. I'm confident.
I would love for you to look into that. And
I'm sorry?
I'd love for you to look into that and report back, because the two appear to be in conflict with one another.
Okay.
And I don't believe they are.
Right, right.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I believe Ron taught on that some years ago. Didn't you, Ron? You want to answer the question? Or do you want to refresh your memory?
I do have an answer to that question, but that's all right. I'll
go for it.
It's on the floor.
Well, one of the issues, I think, I mean, I'm inclined to agree with what I've heard you say on that passage before, which is it doesn't deal with the question of anxiety exactly, but there, in the context, there's this question by what he means about this peace of God that guards your hearts. Because in the context, there are two things that are being talked about. There is that immediate statement about not being anxious, but it does follow right after the stuff about Euodia and Syntyche and this fighting that's going on. And one of the choices about what peace means is not inner peace, but very often in the Bible it's interpersonal peace. So it's quite possible to take his admonition here about not being anxious as a response to, I mean, what's happening is that this fighting is going on, because what often happens is we're looking out for ourselves and we think this other person has done something to hurt us or something like that, and so we're being self-protective and all of that kind of thing. So what he's urging is them to remember ultimately that God is the one who is providing. They can put up with, they can live with the fact that the other person has been less than what they want them to be, because they're ultimately looking to God. So, I mean, you could take the peace as being related to the anxiety, but I'm inclined to think in that context, and the kind of anxiety that he's talking about here then, I mean, it would still apply to Jesus in his situation. I would say he was stressed, but the fact that he would say, not my will but yours be done, would say that he's not being anxious in the way that this is describing. And in fact, if someone were in that situation, that, I mean, he would still be gracious to them, even if they were contributing to his having to go to the cross, which is the kind of thing that he'd be advocating there. Mm-hmm. So, something like that.
Yeah. Colossians is where he says, let the peace of Christ rule in your heart. And it's exactly the same kind of thing that Ron is talking about, where I think what he's saying is, it's let the peace of Christ arbitrate in your heart. The peace that he's talking about is your relationship, your fellow believers. Make that, if you're having to decide how to interact with them, have the fact that you have been reconciled to them and them to you by Christ, have that trump all of your other concerns in your relationship with them.
Because Robbie points out, and I've seen this here too, right before, let your be anxious for nothing, the verse before it is, let your forbearing spirit be known to all men, which right. I think it's still related to the battle that's going on there.
Good. Thank you.
This might be saying a similar thing there, but as you had mentioned earlier, that there's a difference between the fear or anxiety or stress that comes from not believing and not trusting, which I think you were arguing was fundamentally different from, and maybe the word isn't anxiety, but some sort of stress or conflict that is just so intense that comes out of belief that still is within the context of an ultimate trust.
Exactly.
I mean, a stressor or a breaking apart that is as extreme as sweating blood.
Right.
And that's not a not, that's, yeah. But I have another question, yeah. or a question. And this is coming a bit out of some of my own questions, so I might be interpolating or going outside some things here. Are you suggesting that within the larger bounds or challenge of trusting God and living within his sovereignty and his ultimate care for us, et cetera, that there are appropriate places to not be stupid or to speak up or to pursue righteousness? I'm having trouble getting words to this, that for ourselves may not even be comfortable, that may be painful to go do that. Are there even places where we should stand up and say, hey, this is not right? If the reason is not to protect ourselves and defend ourselves, take it upon ourselves to do the defending that God needs to do, mm-hmm. but that we are still nonetheless saying this is not
right.
I'm having trouble articulating it.
Let me see if I can get what's behind your question. Are you saying that the fact that God is sovereignly in control of everything doesn't have to require us to be utterly passive, submissive?
Yes, and exactly.
To everything that happens. Yeah, I mean, notice how active Jesus is here.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not seeing a passive person. What, you could have captured me all day, any day in the temple, and you had to come out here by night? I mean, in a way, what a kind of a bold, sassy thing to say on the one hand, but it's worth pointing out. You know, it needs to be pointed out. You guys are cowards.
So,
you guys do not have integrity on your side.
So it might even be not only allowable, if you will, but obedient to stand up and speak out, to point out those things, whether or not it either costs oneself more or actually does work out for good for oneself.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, I mean, now the fact that it could work out good for myself always leaves open the fact that it's not truth I'm standing up for, but I'm being defensive, but not necessarily.
Right.
And so that shouldn't stop us from speaking out for ourselves if an injustice is done against us, for example. It shouldn't stop us that I might benefit from it just because I might benefit from it. It's a matter of it being right or wrong. And there's examples all over the place, from the prophets down to the apostles, of speaking into and against the injustice and the evil and the disobedience and the godlessness of other people.
And that also may cost us
in a present sense.
Usually
it costs.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
I mean, the best example of that is Peter and John before the Sanhedrin later in Acts. And they're basically saying, okay, we'll let you go, but you're going to have to shut up. You don't be teaching this Jesus stuff anymore. And I love the response. Well, as to whether you should obey God or man, I'll leave that up to you to decide. But as for us, we must obey God.
How do you, verses 43 and 44 are contested by some people because of the manuscript evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And have you settled that? In your own mind?
Not settled it completely, because I didn't spend a lot of time on it, and I'm dangerous here because I'm going by memory, but I believe it's a matter of the majority of manuscripts include, which verse were you talking about?
43 and 44.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was thinking of the other Okay, 40, which one is that?
43, an angel in heaven appeared to him, strengthening in agony. He was praying very fervently, was sweating, became like drops of blood falling on the ground.
Yeah, I wouldn't have included it if I hadn't, but I don't remember why. Okay. I'll have to look at that. I'll have to check on it.
I mean, it just seems to me that his agony could be one of working up the strength to commit to the decision he's already made, that he's not oscillating between obeying and disobeying God, but having made the commitment to obey God, he's now praying for to build himself up to go through what's about to happen, rather than seeing it as a struggle between the two. It's more of a struggle to do the one.
Okay, maybe you're talking about it. I'm lost. So what's the textual variant again?
The 43 and 44 are not in some of the older manuscripts, apparently. And so if it did creep in as a editor's choice to illustrate some point about Jesus, then the question is moot. If it's real, it has given rise to all sorts of speculation that that's Jesus' moment of truth. Are you gonna or are you not? But even if it is true, I could still view that as in verse 41 and 42, he sits down and he has settled the decision whether or not he's going to obey God. The prayer and the agony is not to make that decision, but rather, having made the decision and realizing what lies before him for having made it, he is actually praying and preparing himself, strengthening himself to do what he has chosen to do.
Right.
It no longer becomes an issue, well, how human and how frail and how risky that moment was in the history of humankind for Jesus, but rather it becomes a more of he's made the commitment. He's going to obey God. It's settled. That's not what he's in agony over. What he's in agony over is he has this, he knows what's coming. He is already experiencing in his own mind the pain, the separation, the aloneness, the torture, the rejection, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that, you could stay in prayer about that because you know it's coming, not because you're deciding whether or not it's coming.
Right. That's how I would read it. Yeah. Yeah, I think right in the middle of this, you see the pretty clear evidence of where his ultimate commitment lies. He's not wavering on that. I need to let you go. Thanks.